Hello and welcome to the DC Insider Employer Update Podcast. This podcast updates you with the expertise and current insight of the Washington, D.C.-based attorneys from the Fortney Scott Law Firm. Each episode highlights the most important issues and analysis that employers need to know in order to understand and react to key federal developments affecting their business. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as legal advice on any subject matter. Now let's turn it over to our host, David Fortney.
Hi, everyone. David Fortney again with another edition of DC Insider, What Employers Need to Know. And I might say Happy New Year, both to Bert and Nita. How you doing, Bert?
Oh, very well, David. It's good to be back. And Happy New Year to everyone.
Hey, Nita.
Hi, how are you? Happy New Year to everyone. And it looks like we're going to have a slam bang 2023 so far.
Boy, aren't we off to a start. So we're just coming back from our holidays. Like everyone, we tried to take a little bit of time away. But gosh, we come back, you know, the lame duck. We had got a lot done at the end. And of course, the first week or so of January is proving to be very exciting here in Washington. So what we'd like to do is just take a little bit of time with everyone. And let's start with the lame duck, because we had talked about this before the holiday, that this was going to be a very busy time and, you know, questioning what Congress would or wouldn't get done or could or couldn't get done. I would have to say they got quite a bit done. And we should take a little bit of time to review the bidding, because I think like us, most people are just coming back online now. And let's get caught up on what they did. First, and perhaps most important for the country as a whole, they actually passed an appropriations bill for the current fiscal year. So we did not have a federal government shutdown. And the $1.7 trillion Appropriations Act was passed 2 days before Christmas on December 23. And the president signed that into law over the holiday. And that provides all the agencies with funding for the upcoming fiscal year, which goes through September 30th. Additionally, the bill had not just money for the agencies, but there were some substantive legal changes, including ones that are very important for employers. Expanded protections for pregnant women and nursing mothers, showing once again, no matter what your political views or camp is, everyone likes to show an accomplishment for civil rights and to promote that. But there were compromises that were made to achieve those results, including that the much sought child tax credit, the free breakfast and lunch programs, and some other supporting efforts were opted, ultimately not included, in a negotiated package. But honestly, that is how things used to work, and that's largely how things worked in this lame duck session. My personal theory is maybe it's because we had many members who weren't coming back, so they didn't have accountability or the pressures of re-election, and they felt a little freer to vote in ways they wanted to. Well, let's turn, because some of our agencies, of course, are included in those appropriations bills. And Bert, I know you've had a chance to look at that. Who are the winners and who are the losers?
Well, you know, everybody talks about $1.7 trillion. They're not doing so at the Department of Labor or at the enforcement agencies. This was a lump of coal budget. Get this, the Department of Labor itself, you know, not the agencies, but the big Department of Labor received less than a 1% increase. It's staggering. OFCCP, less than 2%. Wage and Hour and OSHA, who two of the busiest in the government, 3% increases. NLRB, everybody talks about the NLRB getting $25 million increase, which was 9%. But that's the first increase the NLRB has had since 2014. And it's barely enough money to keep the doors open in light of the increase in organizing activity and the increase of unfair labor practice activity. People don't realize the NLRB does its own lawyering at the grassroots level all the way through the board. So this is kind of a shot across the bow from Congress. And this was a Democratic-controlled Congress. These increases are paltry. And I think this is a kind of harbinger of what the next budget's going to be for these enforcement agencies.
How did EEOC do, Bert?
They got an 8% increase. But again, you know, everybody, as you say, everybody wants to show that they're carrying the flag for civil rights. EEOC has done passingly little. Mind you, they've had problems with not having a full commission, but it was kind of surprising that they were the most rewarded of all of the enforcement agencies.
Interesting. Well, Nita, Congress also, as I understand, did enact some bills, substantive legal changes and expansion of protections for employees and new obligations for employers. What's the highlight reel on that from this lame duck session?
Well, there's two things that I think we want to cover. One is this Pump for Nursing Mothers Act. It covers 9 million workers who were not included in the 2010 bill that expanded requirements that employers provide opportunities for nursing mothers to actually have time at work. And so what particularly they did was they have to provide them with a private space for pumping and breaks for pumping. It does give some clarification for employers. There are some people that are exempted in transportation, but the exemptions are limited compared to what they were prior. The other one is just showing that mothers in all kinds, mothers and mothers-to-be, were high on the list, at least for this particular Congress, Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. As we recall, the ADA did not protect or did not require reasonable accommodations for pregnant, they call them pregnant people. I generally think of pregnant women, but nevertheless, pregnant workers were not necessarily covered. And employers have not been particularly, they've been reticent, to be honest, to give accommodations that pregnant women need, such as going to the bathroom, having waters, being able to sit during shifts and so forth. EEOC will be the enforcing agency, and this will require employers to provide these accommodations when needed, just as it would for individuals with disabilities.
So those are both, I think, significant bills, and I actually think they've been underreported so far in the accomplishments by the now just concluded 117th Congress. But there were some other significant acts, I think, for employers. And let's touch on those for a minute, because I think it's worth recapping.
I think the one that got a lot of press, and deservedly so, was the Respect for Marriage Act. In mid-December, President Biden signed the Respect for Marriage Act, which protects same-sex and interracial marriages, largely because of Justice Thomas's comments during the abortion hearing decision. But all it does is requires federal and state governments to recognize a same-sex marriage as legal in their state if it was valid in the state in which the ceremony took place. So that no matter what your own state law is, if a same-sex marriage took place validly elsewhere, you must recognize it. It's kind of the full faith and credit and supremacy clause. You know, you have to, each state has to recognize the valid laws of another state. But to get this bipartisan support, and it was bipartisan, an amendment was added that religious institutions are allowed to deny, and I quote, services, accommodations, advantages, facilities, goods, or privileges for the solemnation or celebration of a marriage. In short, a religious institution can still refuse to host or officiate a wedding ceremony or provide services in the name of religious liberty. Mind you, the exception will apply in very few cases. Nobody's going to force a church to perform a wedding they don't want. But it is significant because of what it didn't do. A state, for example, can still prohibit a same-sex marriage in that state. And this whole idea of carving out rights and privileges is kind of a threat to other forms of civil liberty. It's quite controversial. The implications of the precedent are widely debated. And I think if you're looking at the crystal ball, this kind of carve out is going to be added to every kind of bill they can. They tried to add it to the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, and it was defeated. So there's some sense of limitations. But as we reported over the past year, the advance of religious rights as becoming first among equals seems to be continuing.
That's interesting. The interplay between federalism, the respect for state rights, versus creating federal guarantees or standards, that continues. Juanita, one of the other bills I know deals with various non-disclosure agreements, which used to be a standard tool in the tool chest that we would use all the time with clients. Are we facing new requirements there?
Well, we are, I think. This was interesting because Gretchen Carlson, who used to work at Fox News, had to sign a non-disclosure agreement after she cut a deal with Fox after alleging discrimination, sex harassment, and sexual assault, I believe, by Roger Ailes. And so she set up a group and pushed hard at Congress to, at the very least, bar the use of pre-dispute non-disclosure agreements for sexual harassment and sexual assault. Now, this is pre-dispute. You can still get a non-disclosure agreement once you actually make a settlement. That's still allowed. Now, I think already, although in this Congress it's unlikely, I expect that you will see a push to expand this pre-dispute non-disclosure agreements to cover other protected categories, race, gender generally, and so forth. But this is a big deal. All of these, the other two laws we talked about, have been around for over 10 years, as has this. So this move forward is a big one, I think, for employers and employees.
And this is really, it seems to me, the most recent chapter in the Me Too resulting and all the changes that occurred to make sure that people are not subject to reporting restrictions or disclosure restrictions that have experienced harassment.
And you remember in February, President Biden signed another barred mandatory arbitration also on sexual harassment and sexual assault, which I think is another piece of that hashtag Me Too.
Agreed. Well, certainly one of the other areas that the 117th Congress, this involves the Senate, is the confirmation. And we focus a lot on who's confirmed at the agencies, but judges are critical for a whole host of reasons. And Bert, I know you've been tracking that. Where are we?
This is a real success for President Biden, and I'm surprised more attention hasn't been focused. The president has nominated 150 federal judges so far. 97 have been confirmed. It's the most of any president in the first 2 years of her term, and they cover from the Supreme Court to the appellate court down to the federal district courts, like almost 70 federal district court judges. But who they are seems to me to be even more significant than the sheer numbers. Listen to this. 74% of the judicial nominees and conferees are women. 46% are women of color. Of the 46 nominees that haven't been confirmed, 25 are women. And of that, two-thirds, 18 are women of color. This is a revolution in the judiciary, which has not only historically not reflected the demography of the country, it hasn't even reflected the demography of eligible lawyers. The president is going, you know, bending over backwards, really, to try to right this historic oversight. And this is what we have, and it's going to keep going.
I think the thing to point out, too, is we can see the impact that judges have based on the things that have been going on, obviously, the Supreme Court, but district courts as well. And the Democrats, it looks like, have finally learned their lesson that judges are the most important thing to confirm. But David, there's an opportunity for them, because they kept the Senate, to confirm some of these other nominees as well.
Yeah, there is. And certainly with respect to the agencies, which quite surprisingly, after 2 years, we still have some key vacancies. We've talked about this off and on, and I'm sure some of our listeners think, gosh, are they a broken record? Why don't they move on? Because it does feel a bit like Groundhog Day. But we have the EEOC's nominee, Kapana Koudagul. That would be the third Democratic commissioner. So out of a five-member agent commission, that would be the third critical vote that would really allow the implementation of this administration's agenda and priorities. But her nomination lapsed. She did not make it. She was not confirmed. She almost got through at the end, but that did not occur. And similarly, the EEOC is without a general counsel, and the career staff have been performing those functions for the interim 2 years. Recall President Biden opened up his administration by firing several high-profile people, including the general counsel of the EEOC. But Carla Gilbride still remains unconfirmed. So both of those nominations now have been resubmitted just this week in the new 118th Congress. So they have to basically start that process over, which is very time consuming. Jessica Luman, also, I should mention, for Wage Hour, she did not make it. We anticipate she will be renominated and, in my opinion, likely will be confirmed. But I want to put a little sunshine on one that did get confirmed, and that is the head of the Office of Management and Budget the OIRA. What does that acronym stand for? Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, which in plain speak, that is the agency in the White House that reviews and approves all regulations and related materials that every agency puts out. So it's a very critical position. And Richard Revesz was confirmed. Prior nominee did not make it. And that's a very critical role for any administration, but particularly this one that has made it very clear that it wants to engage in broad-based rulemaking. So this is the person whose hand will be on that throttle in the White House as those regs get confirmed. So I think there were plenty of accomplishments for the 117th, certainly in this last 3 to 6 months. We've highlighted some of those. But now we have the 118th Congress in session, sort of, because as we're recording this, we're watching what's going on in the House. But Nita, you've been monitoring up there. What do we have going on in the new Congress, 118th Congress, so far?
Well, at 2:23 Eastern Standard Time on Thursday, January the 5th, Kevin McCarthy has lost a seventh battle to become the new Speaker of the House. What will happen after this? Even though he apparently gave significant concessions to those who oppose his nomination. Interestingly, and I just throw this to the two of you, it does not have to be a Republican who becomes Speaker. So there could be a coalition. There are 212 Democrats who consistently have voted for the head of the Democratic Party in the House. If they could get six Republicans, he could become the Speaker of the House.
Highly unlikely. I mean, the Republicans have waited for 6 years to get the House back, and I don't think they're going to give away. Because remember, the Speaker appoints committee chairs, subcommittee chairs, controls the agenda. I don't think they're going to give it away, but I don't know what's going to happen.
Right. Well, I think that's right. So it's chaos at the moment. One thing that we do know within the House has been pretty well sorted out is that the Committee of Jurisdiction, the House committee that oversees labor and workplace matters, Dr. Virginia Fox, she will be chairing that committee. And that's a very important committee. That's the one that will drive oversight on the Biden agencies, oversight on the Biden regulations, oversight on the Biden policy issues involving the workplace. That is going to be ground zero for all of those overview and potential challenges that may arise through Congress.
And Dr. Fox, in an oversight hearing involving Jenny Yang of OFCCP and Charlotte Burroughs of EEOC, has already laid down her gauntlet, especially on pay data collection. So buckle up for that.
She thinks both those agencies are out of control.
I don't want to give the impression that only the Republicans are having their internal struggles. You know, David talked about the renomination, particularly of Kalpana Kodagal. Although there are 51 votes in the Democratic caucus, President Biden will be able to get lots of judges pushed through quickly and get most everybody else pushed through quickly. There won't be committee votes. There won't be procedural stalls. But the jury is still out as to whether Senators Manchin and Sinema are going to vote for nominee Kodagal. So there's internal struggle even within the Democratic Party.
I think that's right. Well, look, let's take a few minutes here at the end and just briefly touch on what the agencies are up to. We've touched on what their funding is, and most of the funding that Bert described for us goes to personnel. But they are looking at, and this goes back to that OIRA confirmation head that we talked about. They're looking at a lot of rulemaking. The fall regulatory agenda was just issued on January 4th. Yes, it's still called the fall regulatory agenda. They backdated it. They issued it in January, but whatever. And what is clear from this, and that's basically the playbook, the schedule, what the agencies are planning to issue. It's clear that after a fairly slow start for the first 2 years, most of the workplace agencies are going to be kicking it into gear. And so this year primarily is going to be filled with proposed rulemaking on independent contractor, joint employer, both by the Labor Department and the NLRB. OSHA, in a widely anticipated rule, is imminent. It will be issuing a final regulation dealing with COVID with respect to healthcare. It's expected to be quite broad and not as prescriptive as the emergency temporary standard was. Bert, how about some of the other ones in there?
Well, I think the main ones that you've talked about are the independent contractor and the joint employer, but still also coming from wage and hour is going to be a reappraisal of the overtime threshold rule that got all that controversy during the Obama administration, raising it up to $46,000 and stuff. I think that one's coming down and it will also be challenged. As I mentioned, the nominees that David has talked about are going to be proposed. I think we're going to have a floor fight for EEOC because of all of the implications that will follow that Representative Fox is going to investigate in terms of data collection, sex harassment regulations, and things of that kind. So we have a full plate.
Right. And as those rulemakings start rolling along during the year, we'll pick those up in real time and really unpack them for people as the proposed rules come out, and certainly as the final rules come out. Most of them will be towards the end of this calendar year or later. Well, we're getting near the end. I always like to say, what are our final thoughts and where are we and where do we go? So Bert, I'm going to start with you. Where are we as we start 2023?
Nita kind of set the stage. I like to say, is this a Whig moment? In 1850s, the Whig Party disintegrated after, 133 votes to elect a speaker? And it was over irreconcilable internal differences, internal policy differences. In that case, of course, slavery. The defectors, by the way, included Abraham Lincoln, who was one of the founders of the new Republican Party. So is past prologue? Is this a Whig moment? Are they going to keep voting into next week? Are we going to get 10, 20, 30 votes? And what's going to be the upshot of that?
That's very interesting and a very good reminder. To some degree, we've seen this movie, maybe. Nita, I'm going to give you the last word. I'll just jump in here. I think that this rulemaking agenda that we just touched on briefly, this is going to consume a lot of effort and be really important. This is what we anticipated this administration will be doing. They've been very slow in getting going, but they are clearly going when we look at that rulemaking agenda schedule that they put out. The other thing is, I think that the Senate judicial confirmations are going to continue rapidly. The president, the administration fully understands the unique opportunity they have, and they're going to put the pedal to the metal to exercise that 51 vote majority they've got. Nita, you get the final word.
Well, I think it's important to recognize we're rolling into January of a new year, and many states are rolling out new laws around pay transparency, paid leave, and a lot of other things that we can't seem to get through the federal agencies or through the Congress. And so I think we're going to continue to see the states driving new workplace enforcement because of the challenges in actually getting federal regulations out, including the Trumpian federal courts, who are now taking the position that much of the regulation, in some cases, is not authorized under the statutes.
I think that's a good reminder of how challenging the environment is going to be in 23, aside from the economic challenges and others. The compliance landscape is going to continue to be changing very quickly. So, all right. Well, Nita and Bert, happy 2023. I'm looking forward to another exciting year of our podcast, and we wish everyone the best. And if you haven't already, please consider subscribing. Hit that button on DC Insider, What Employers Need to Know. We really appreciate everyone joining us. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. We look forward to the next update. For those that would like to connect with any of the lawyers from Fortney Scott, please reach out to them directly by visiting fortneyscott.com. On the website, you can also listen to previous podcast episodes, as well as pick up your copy of the DC Insider Report and sign up for future updates. Thanks so much for listening.